Hi, everyone. We are still in the 1970s, but we are making progress.
Hey, at this rate, we'll be in the 80s before Labor Day.
I'm not sure if you're being facetious or serious.
Okay, no, I really think we will be there by August, actually, if you don't remember or find something we've missed.
And if we don't miss recording any episodes, we'll be having our 100th episode anniversary probably around New Year's, because we're taking our season break in, what, September? Somewhere
yes.
around there? Okay. All right. Perfect. So we have a milestone coming.
Instead of a question this week, let's invite people to our YouTube community.
Great idea, and I'll include a link to that. And I'm also going to create a poll and ask our listeners on Spotify and Apple if they're interested in doing a community section on the website or something, but we'll do that for the next episode.
Okay, so let's just dive right in today. Today we are going to cover the 1977 gambling charges that were brought against Ilario Zanino, aka Larry Bioni, A.B. Sarkis, Melvin Berger, and others.
And we will wrap it up with the arrest of Dominic Isabella in September of 1978. Dominic was the first guy that Dad flipped on in September of 62. And in a twist of irony, Dominic's second cousin named Florio Isabella was believed to be the first made man who became an FBI informant back in 1956.
Ooh, I get to throw out one of my mob fun facts.
And you didn't get a chance last week.
Yeah, well, we had zero opportunity since you stuck us back in IRA land.
Hey, listen. Like my uncle used to say, anything after but is an excuse.
Okay. Well, here it is. Florio Isabella, the second cousin of Dominic Isabella, was the stepfather of soprano star Joe Pantoliano.
Pantoliano.
I can't. Okay.
All right. Anyhow, we should include the link in from the Cigar Aficionado interview with Joe when he explains how he put him on the straight and narrow path.
Sure. Okay, now for the case. Back to Boston. For 18 days in October of 1975, 140 phone calls that were placed on two separate phone lines in a Roslindale bookie office were recorded during an FBI and Massachusetts State Police electronic surveillance operation. The feds handled the wiretaps and the stateies the surveillance. Most of the calls were bettors placing wagers on the World Series that Boston was playing and football games, both pro and college. $103,000 in bets were placed during one weekend.
And Larry Bioni had just been released from Leavenworth on October 1st, only a few weeks before the surveillance operation began. We'll talk about Larry's history up to that point in a little bit. The authorities said that the betting operation was raking in a minimum of $2,000 a day. The surveillance also revealed some of the hierarchy of the operation. Larry, A.B. Sarkis, and Milton Berger agreed to share in the profits. Larry provided Milton, the operations manager of sorts, with the money to cover the losses. Milton was also in charge of the phone operations. William Bioni reported the status of the bets to his uncle Larry.
Not long after the surveillance operation came to an end, the feds raided Larry's home in Swampscott along with four other locations on November 10th. The same day, A.B. was detained and searched at Baracci's restaurant in Dedham, but neither of them were arrested.
Okay, so Baracci's was the spot that I had my last meal with my mother. Now, our listener, Wanda, who I think is my cousin, actually, I have to find out. Wanda, let me know if you're my cousin, requested stories about Mom. So this kind of fits in perfectly, especially the timing was pretty close. And I don't like telling these stories.
I know, but I keep encouraging you to share them because I think people like them.
I just don't know that anyone wants to hear about mine, but here goes. I'm going to skip the backstory and maybe at some point in time we'll get to it in another episode. So my parents had been separated for a couple of months at that point, and Dad asked me if I wanted my mom to come home. And what kid doesn't want their mother home? So I said yes. Mom came home, and a couple of days later, we went to Baracci's for dinner. Now, it was really normal for my parents to take me everywhere with them, and Saturday nights were, you know, a big thing for us to go out late and have dinner together. When Dad got up to go to the men's room, Mom grabbed me and ran out. There was a car parked outside that must have been left there for her earlier. I had overheard Dad and the guys talking about what would happen if Mom tried to take me, and the consensus amongst them was that they would have to kill her. Remember, I'm only 6 years old at this point, and I didn't really know murder, killing, this, that, and the other thing, but other people had been killed in, you know, in dad's circle or in my life at, by that point. And so I knew that, you know, you get killed, you're not coming back. You're gone. And that's the end of it. And I didn't want my mother to die. So I screamed, I cried, I panicked, and I was begging her, please bring me back to dad. Eventually she brought me to a phone booth. At that point, it was probably, it had to be after 11 o'clock at night because I got home, I want to say that it was midnight. So she left me in the phone booth at the Howard Johnson's that was on the Southeast Expressway. It's where Bay Cove Shopping Center is now over there. And the last thing I remember was being in the phone booth with her, and she called my father and said, you have to come and get her. If you don't come and get her, I'm going to kill her. And that was the last time I saw my mom.
Wow. I know I've heard it before, but it's still disturbing to listen to.
Look, and I've always said the same thing, and I never felt any sort of anger or animosity towards her. She had no choice. I absolutely do not blame her. I ran away from home, so I certainly don't blame her for what she did. Anyhow, let's get back to the story because I don't think we want to bore anybody anything further. So back to our bookies. It would be some 14 months until the charges were brought against Larry and the rest of the boys.
So on January 31st, 1977, 11 men were indicted on charges of conducting an illegal gaming operation in the Boston area and in Minneapolis.
How did Minneapolis get thrown in there?
I don't know. I'm just telling you what the charges were.
And who were our 11 fine entrepreneurs?
They were Larry, Abe, Melvin, John, Action Jackson Salemi, Joseph Setapain, Joseph Fuller, Vartan McKellian, Fred Abraham, Ronald Kaplan, and Larry's two nephews, Philip and William. On Friday that week, seven of them were arraigned. Berger, McKellian, Abraham, Kaplan, the two Bayonis, and A.B. Sarkis entered not guilty pleas.
If anyone just heard that sigh of boredom, that was the dog, not me. Salemi, Setapain, and Fuller were arraigned the following Monday. All were released on $1,000 bail. And as we mentioned, during the making ceremony of 1977 episode, Larry was hospitalized with a heart condition, so his arraignment had to be postponed. So let's give a recap of Larry's history.
Sure. And for people that want a deeper dive, check out episode 22 from season one, The Nightlight. Ilario Antonio Maria Zanino was born on June 15, 1920, to Isabella Lagrada Bayona and Joseph Zanino. Isabella had four sons from her previous marriage, Louis, Frank, Peter, and Philip. Like many of the other men we've been discussing, Larry boxed in his teens. On his draft card from 1941, he was listed as a farmer employed by his half-brother, Louis.
And I can't believe you're not going to let me tell the pig farm story.
Just because you have actual pigs living in your neighborhood, you find it intriguing, but normal people don't. You should post a photo, though.
Of the pigs? Sure. Why
yes.
not? I'll use what? Of my pigs?
Yes.
Okay, I'll put my pigs in the slideshow. Okay. All right. And you can put it on the Twitter account for the people that don't follow on. Thank you. Okay. In June of 1960, Larry was arrested along with Leo Santaniello, Phil Wagenheim, Richard Red Acid, which should be Assad, but everyone said Acid, and Edward Franks for what the authorities dubbed a pay-or-die scheme. They were shaking down business owners offering protection. If the businessman didn't pay up, they were threatened and eventually beaten. So then they needed protection. Even though it was from the guy that was beating them, they had to still get the protection from the same guy. And maybe we'll get a little bit more about Red later.
Okay. So when they appeared in court on June 29th, Larry was called the head of the New England Crime Syndicate by the assistant DA. Larry's wife showed up at the Charles Street Jail with a bag filled with $25,000 in small bills to bail him out. Picture that in your head.
Mm-hmm.
In December, Larry, Phil, and Leo pleaded guilty to the extortion charges. They were each sentenced to 4 to 7 years in state prison.
In October of 1964, just before Larry was due to be released, Raymond Patriaca was picked up on the wiretap of the Coin-O-Matic gossiping about Larry and Joe Burns potentially having a conflict with Larry when he hit the streets. Raymond speculated that Larry would want his street action back, including one of the guys who had previously worked for him.
Well, it was around this time that the hierarchy of the relationship between the men changed. Larry and Edward Romano became captains, the LaMattina brothers were said to be his soldiers, and Jerry Angiulo was their boss. In early March of 1970, a Senate subcommittee confirmed this hierarchy. Then, on March 25th that same year, Larry, along with Joe LaMattina and six others, were indicted on stolen securities charges, all thanks to Vinnie Teresa's testimony.
You mean tale-telling, not testimony.
Hey, instead of being Fat Vinny, he should have been Lying Vinny.
Seriously. Larry also ended up being charged with a $300,000 jewelry heist that took place in November of 66. I'm sorry, it took place in March of 1966. Joseph Bolero and Peter Lamoni were also indicted. The trial commenced in November of 1970. After 10 hours of deliberation, they were all convicted on November 16th. But this time the witness wasn't Vinny, but rather one of the alleged heist participants, Erwin Sirocco. Larry and Peter Lamoni were both sentenced to 7 years. Lamoni was already doing life in Walpole after being railroaded by the government for killing Teddy Deegan.
Exactly. And just to clarify, Joseph Bolero was not attorney Joe Bolero, but they were first cousins.
Thank you for clearing that one up. Now let's jump back into the case. On July 14th, 1977, 10 of the 11 pleaded guilty. Good old Judge Toro accepted their guilty pleas and scheduled a sentencing hearing for Sarkis and Berger on July 22nd, and the others, minus Larry, would be sentenced on August 17th.
But only because Larry was still in his hospital bed, convalescing from his alleged heart condition.
Don't get snarky. Before we get into the sentencing of Abe and Melvin, do you want to tell their bios or do their bios?
Sure, I'll start with Abe. He was born Abraham Bashara Sarkis on December 9, 1913, to Bashara Sarkis and Hamama Mamie Solomon, both Melkite Catholic immigrants from Lebanon. Abe and his wife Dorothy had 2 children, a boy and a girl.
I love how you pronounce the name properly and not in the Boston way. Abe's first arrest was in 1935 for bookmaking. In April of 1940, a fire and explosion occurred in the hallway outside of the Sarkis family apartment in South Bend of Boston. Abe, his wife Dorothy, and their baby and future restaurateur Charlie barely made it out. Abe suffered severe cuts on his arms and face from the flying glass that was caused by the blast.
Well, you have to wonder if someone was trying to smoke him out to steal his stash.
Another rhyme from you. Actually, I rhymed too before that. We're both becoming poets. But it's certainly possible that someone was trying to get the money from him. On May 8, 1944, he and Doc Sagansky and 6 others were arrested for taking bets on a licensed boxing match. Then in June of 1955, Sarkis was ordered to appear before the Massachusetts Crime Commission along with Doc Sagansky and Johnny Williams, among others, as part of an investigation into gambling operations in the state. The 3 men were named the top bookies in Massachusetts.
But the authorities were having difficulties tracking them down. Sagansky was in California, according to his attorney, but Johnny and Abe were AWOL. It wouldn't be until March of 57 that they managed to get Abe and Johnny, and by then a gaggle of defendants, into custody. The investigation did not lead to any charges.
In 1960, Dorothy Sarkis answered the door of their Brush Hill Road home in Milton. She opened the door after seeing one of the men was dressed as a priest, but she quickly realized that the other one had a gun and screamed to her husband. Now, I often see the story that he escaped by jumping out of a bedroom window, but I always heard that he refused to open the safe and they rolled him in a carpet and threw him out the window.
I have visions of one of those fantastic oriental carpets that we used to see in Armenia.
Oh, totally. Hand-knotted silk, pattern telling a story, pristine fringe all along the 2 ends.
Let's not get off track.
Right, relax. In May of 1967, a bar in the South End that Abe was running was raided in a joint operation between the IRS and the Boston Police Department. Sarkis and his brother were both arrested on allegations of bookmaking. His operation was just one of many targeted by the authorities that month. Meanwhile, Sarkis was scheduled to appear in court the following day on tax evasion charges that dated back a decade.
In November of 68, he pleaded guilty to 1 charge of tax evasion and was given a 9-month jail sentence and fined $10,000. The other charges were dropped as part of the plea agreement. Things were quiet until the gaming investigation.
Okay, so let's talk about Melvin Berger now. He was born on April 12, 1925, to Alexander Berger and Rose Cohen in Boston. His mother married Louis Kubitsky after his father died in 1934. Melvin married Frieda Sopkin in 1946. Melvin's early days were spent making the honor roll year after year, just as it should have been.
And he managed to stay off the radar until the gambling case. So let's get back to the case and the sentencing. On July 22, 1977, Judge Charo fined Sarkis and Berger $30,000 each. In addition, the 2 men were sent to work at the Fernald School for 60 hours a month for the following 3 years. Marty Lepo represented Abe and pointed out to the court that his daughter held Olympic gold and silver in the equestrian category.
I don't think that lessened his sentence. By the way, you know what the Fernald was, right?
No.
Well, besides being a pigsty and a disgrace, not just according to Judge Toro, it was really the only public school for children with special needs. You know, in those days, they still used the R words. We can't put that out there, but that's what they called it. Toro told Abe and Melvin to make their children and grandchildren proud by helping the kids there.
Well, Abe told Toro that he had seven grandchildren and seven restaurants and was going to take the straight and narrow.
Yeah, sure he was. On August 18th, Toro fined the other eight men, and sent them to work at the Fernald also.
Well, the Fernald was a happening place those days.
Well, I hope the kids were at least entertained by that colorful parade of characters.
Likewise, but one was still missing. Larry Bayoni was the only one left facing charges. In October, he sought to have those charges dismissed on account of his poor health, claiming that he couldn't attend his own trial. His attorney, Joe Valero, filed to have the charges dismissed. According to him, Larry had been in and out of the hospital with heart problems all year.
And that saga would carry on for years. The volunteers weren't minding their P's and Q's either. In November, Melvin was arrested at the Fernald, this time on charges of running an illegal $25 million a year gambling operation in violation of his parole agreement. Berger had promised Judge Toro in July that he would find a new line of work, but apparently he just couldn't help himself. The picture of him in the scally cap and cuffed reminds me of Dad when he was old.
I can't.
Just saying.
Despite the sentences already imposed, the case dragged on, likely in an effort to enforce the charges against Larry. In February of 78, a grand jury called on Berger and Ralphie LaMattina as witnesses in an undisclosed case. But the rumor was that it had something to do with Jerry Angiulo and his connection to a loan sharking ring. Ralphie told reporters that he had no clue why he'd been called, but then proceeded to leave the room every time he was asked a question to consult loudly in the hall with his attorney, Joe Valero.
One of the questions was about October 13th, 1975. At the meeting that we earlier mentioned at Baracci's that was attended by A.B. Sarkis, Melvin Berger, Larry Bayoni, and Jerry Angiulo. After the meeting, Melvin went on his way, but the others went to meet with Joe Russo at the Cafe Pompeii.
Ralphie was asked to identify the voices on a recording, but that wasn't going anywhere. Jerry was subpoenaed to testify the following week, but he attempted to quash the summons. The feds also tried to serve papers to JR, but he'd gone AWOL. Judge Skinner denied Jerry's motion to quash. Jerry's attorneys, William Santolo and Gerald Alch, tried one last time to appeal, saying he was being targeted because of the gambling case against the boys.
When Melvin was summoned, he refused to talk, not even invoking the Fifth Amendment, so contempt charges were sought against him. By the end of March, the struggle to compel Jerry to testify was still ongoing. In the middle of April, he was given a 30-day stay. On May 18th, Melvin was remanded into custody and sent off to the state prison in Concord, New Hampshire until November. The prison had an agreement to hold federal prisoners there who needed medical attention as he was recovering from leg surgery.
So on June 21st, Edward Harrington signed a letter of immunity in order to compel Jerry's testimony, and his lawyers even tried to appeal that. Finally, on June 27th, Jerry spent 2 hours testifying in front of the secret grand jury.
Talk about drawn out. On September 15th, the self-serve laundry on the corner of Shawmut Ave and Union Park, my old neighborhood, was raided. Wiretaps led to eleven warrants, but once again, Larry slipped through their fingers.
Hey, he was supposedly in the hospital again with his bad ticker.
Well, lucky Larry, but Red Acid and Dominic Isabella weren't so lucky. Dominic was pinched at the laundry and Red at his home and his lovely English tutor in West Roxbury. Now, I wanted to tell some of Red's story and the Dominic story, but for the sake of time, maybe we'll wait to talk more about Red when we backtrack to the loan sharking charges when we return after the fall of an empire. What do you think?
I think that's a smart idea.
I can't believe I just got all those words out of my mouth in one shot. So Dominic Isabella and his family, including the women, were major heroin dealers going back to at least the 1910s in New York. He was born in Boston and was the youngest child and only son of Florio D. Isabella. This is not the Florio Isabella who was the stepfather of Joe Pantoliano, but rather his first cousin. To add to it, sometimes Dominic also used the name Florio, which was actually short for Florindo. Dominic's father killed a 16-year-old boy in New Jersey in 1923 for harassing his younger sister. Dominic was born in Massachusetts 2 years later, where his father and his uncle Angelo were picked up on narcotics charges in 1925. There was a story out there that Dominic was born and raised in New York and was made by the Colombo family.
But who wasn't rumored to have been made by the Colombo family?
Look, if all those guys were made members of the Colombo family, they'd have like an actual army working for them. They'd probably be the most powerful families. Besides the other Florio that we mentioned before was a member of the Lucchese family. Another rumor said that Larry Zanino bought Dominic to Massachusetts after they did time together in Atlanta. They did not do time together in Atlanta. And I know you're going to bring up that on his death certificate, someone said New York that he was born, but we know from the census and his birth records that he was born in Massachusetts. Dominic spent his whole life in Massachusetts. He had arrests for narcotics, especially heroin, going back to 1949 when he was picked up with his uncle Angelo in Somerville and went to the federal pen in Michigan, but not for long. He was arrested again in January of 1953 for heroin and sentenced to 3 to 5 years in state prison in Massachusetts. Then in September of 1962, he was arrested with Dad and Charles Contreras for buying a kilo of heroin off of an undercover federal agent.
And we know that that was the first case that Richie gave to the feds after being recruited, so to speak, by H. Paul Rico in May of that year.
Exactly. The charges are dropped against Dad, and Dominic was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison in January of 1963 for that case and for selling heroin in August of 1962. And Contreras was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. And although Isabella's people tried to kill Dad a couple of times, obviously he escaped unscathed. But my Uncle Brendan cursed Dad until his last breath for the rooftop chases that ruined the family.
And on that note, let's wrap it up today. We have two upcoming Hit Parade episodes to work on, and you probably will be heading to the bomb shelter soon.
Listen, don't curse me, and you need to spit 3 times when you say stuff like that.
I'll leave the superstitious stuff to you, but knock on wood.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
Bye.